You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and this is my interview with the director of The Devil All the Time, Antonio Campos, and Daniel Howitt's interview with the cinematographer, Lo Crawley.
Happy birthday, Arvin.
Happy birthday, honey.
Happy birthday to you.
Well, this was your daddy's. Brought back from the war. It's time to pass it on.
It's the best present I ever got. Thank you.
How and why people from two points on a map without even a straight line between them can be connected is at the heart of our story in Knock'em Stiff.
You ever think about how we ended up orphans living in the same house?
I know what my daddy did.
Some people would say it's just dumb luck.
You take pictures?
I do. I see a smile pretty enough to photograph, that is.
Others would tell you it was God's plan.
Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness.
That ain't no preacher. He's as bad as they got on him.
All right, this is Matt Neglia with Next Best Picture. I'm being joined today by the co-writer and director of the new Netflix film, Antonio Campos. Antonio, how are you today?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Considering the circumstances that 2020 has given us with COVID and everything else, I'm doing well.
Good.
Yeah, so I wanted to first start off by giving you a quick bit of background, actually, on myself about something. I was brought up a Catholic. I went to Catholic school my entire life, pretty much, all the way up until college. So religion was really, really thrust upon me. And I was just curious to know, was it the same for you growing up? Like, what kind of an impact did religion play into your life? Because, you know, you got to admit, as you get older, you start questioning some things.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you ask that. So I was raised Catholic. My mother and her father, my grandfather, were very devout Catholic, devout. they were very devout. And so I was raised with them as a model, but I was also raised by my father, who had gone to Catholic school like you, like his whole life, had gone to Catholic school. And by the time that I was around, had decided I'd been to church enough and he wouldn't like go to church. And he never really engaged in any sort of religious conversation, you know? And so I had these two examples and, you know, devout, religious people, but I also like I didn't get confirmed, and so I like there were like gaps in my Catholic experience, you know what I mean? And so there was an aspect of that that I also didn't have. So I had like this strange in and out, like kind of a push and pull kind of relationship with it. And I remember at some point I started to like really notice things that the Catholic Church was doing that just like, this is wrong. Like that, you know, the organization felt different than what the message of Catholicism was. And I started thinking about that a lot and so that was my relationship with it. I've struggled with it. I've used my work to try and explore a little bit of that.
Yeah, there's a reason why I wanted to open up actually with that question. It's because I think it informs so much the approach that this story took, even though it is based on the 2011 novel. To me, with this pattern of violence and it being passed down the same way that religion is passed down generation to generation, it struck me almost as like an angry film, a condemnation, if you will, towards religion. What would you say is like your approach towards it today?
My approach towards religion?
Yeah.
I don't have a strong relationship with religion. I have a spiritual side. And I live in a constant state of questioning. And I feel like that for me is kind of just a natural place to be in a state of questioning and looking for an answer. And sometimes it's hard for me to, I embrace the questioning. I don't fight it. I think that, you know, the film is trying to condemn those that abuse their powers, those in positions of power in the church that abuse that power, and people that take religion, whatever it may be, to the extreme, and acknowledging the place that religion has, the healthy place that it has for certain characters in the story as well.
Mm-hmm. Your brother, I was looking him up on IMDb, and I didn't see any credit other than the co-written credit here. And I was curious to know, like, what was that collaboration process like in adapting the novel and working alongside Paula?
My brother had never written a script before, so this was the first script he'd written. And he'd written prose, like short stories. He'd written a novel. He hasn't published it. But he and I loved this kind of literature. We both love Flannery O'Connor. Like, we love Jim Thompson. And this book, to us, was this amazing hybrid of the kind of stories that we really loved. And my brother, much like you, went to Catholic school his whole life. So he has a very particular, specific relationship with religion, too. Mm-hmm. And so we were both drawn to the material for similar reasons. And the process was very collaborative, you know. The process was really kind of first figuring out what aspects of each storyline, each character we really loved, and then figuring out what the in and out of each story was and what we just had to cut from the book, and then shaping the sort of bigger narrative around that. And then Don was really a big part of the sound of the narrator. I mean, it was his voice. Mm-hmm. And he was like, a lot of the narration is pulled from the book. A lot of it is made up. And then over the course of editing, we would get, my wife is the editor, and we would get ideas of a place here or there that we needed a voiceover. And then we would write something, we'd send it to Don. Don would record it right away, send it back, and sometimes do an alt version. And so that was a really great collaborative process. And through that process, Don became more and more comfortable sort of as a performer, you know, as a, yeah, as a narrator.
Yeah, the voice of God over the film, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that you brought up your wife as well. I had another question lined up regarding working alongside her, but it sounds to me like this was a really personal project for you, and getting these people involved and also having it tied to a very specific and very personal aspect of people's lives. You know, you've said before that you're drawn to dark characters or otherwise complicated people, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that's not what I think of when I think of Tom Holland. I think of MCU Spider-Man right off the top of my head. And I'm sure a lot of other people do as well. So what did you see in Tom that told you, yeah, he's going to be right for this role?
I just saw a really great actor. I just saw a really talented guy who had this kind of, just it's like a little bit of a scrappy quality. Like I could see this kind of like, he's got a kind of that aspect of Arvin that's kind of like just tough. And you believe that he kind of like, you know, in a fight, even if he was like a foot shorter than the other people, could still come out on top. Like he'd figure out. There was that aspect of it. There was a physicality. And I just saw this young guy who was very thoughtful and was just kind of interested in going to this place. And for me, so much of like casting is instinctual. It's like, if someone feels right for a role, follow that instinct. And, yep. And Tom just felt for, and he was, and you know, and I'm very lucky that he was into it.
They say majority of a director's job is done once the film is cast, and the rest kind of hopefully falls into place.
It's a cliche, but it's true. It's really true.
Yep.
You cast the film correctly, it's kind of like you're halfway there.
Mm-hmm. This is, I would argue, the biggest film that you've done yet, in terms of the sprawling cast, the location shooting, everything that went into it. And so I'm curious to know, you had a couple of very big names on this one as well. Not just Tom Holland, but also Pattinson, Sebastian Stan, Riley Keough. You know, there's a lot of great talent involved in this. And I'm curious to know, after going through the experience of working on The Devil All the Time, are you curious to keep on pushing the limit and seeing how high the ceiling really goes in terms of how big your films can get?
Yeah. The career that I would like to have as a director, and that I've been, you know, the kind of directors that I admire are ones that are not pigeonholed into making any one kind of movie or any one genre. And that can go from making, you know, a $100 million tentpole film to making, you know, a $1 million indie. And I think that, you know, I love the idea of just kind of following my gut and seeing where, you know, inspiration takes me. And so, yeah, like I definitely have this at the moment. My ambition is has gotten bigger, and my desire to work on a bigger canvas is you know, that's there. So, you know, that's where I'm at right now. I would love to just to keep sort of creating bigger worlds and working with it's not necessarily about working with a lot of big actors. I just like working with really talented people.
Sure.
And
who doesn't? Right?
Exactly. It's just like at the end of the day, it's like, I never really, you know, I know there's a lot of guys and actors and actresses in this movie that are very famous, but I honestly don't ever think about that. I think about just like the person that's in front of me and the role they're playing. It definitely helps get a film made, though.
Yeah, so, totally.
And it helps get a film seen. So,
I mean, you've got
part of the ecosystem.
Yep. I mean, You've got Batman, you've got Spider-Man, the Winter Soldier. At one point, Captain America was also attached at one time or another. Who knows what doors could possibly open up for Antonio Campos in the future? I'm sure that a lot of conversations were had. In any event, though, you've now worked with Netflix on Punisher, Homemade, now this. Can you talk to us a bit about what it's been like working with Netflix on various different types of projects?
It's always been really positive. I mean, on the first time was probably The Punisher, where it was Marvel and Netflix. You know, I was only experiencing that as a visiting guest director. So that was that experience I saw from the outside. I watched Steve Lightfoot, the show creator, how he was dealing with Marvel and Netflix, and they were super supportive of him as a creator. And they were, and my small interactions with them on that show were very positive and very supportive. And that's continued to be the case. Like, this was a really great experience for me in terms of creatively working with a studio. I felt like I was supported. I felt like I was heard. I felt that we might have had disagreements, but there was always like really good conversation and dialogue, and we always ended up in a place that was better, you know, than mm-hmm. where we started. So it's great. I can't really think of another. They're just like super filmmaker friendly, and they really like sort of pushing the envelope.
Great. Last question, and hopefully it's an easy one right before we go here. We didn't really talk about any spoilers on this. I'm really, really happy about that. So for those that are listening to this prior to watching The Devil All the Time, what is a message that you would like to tell someone before they watch your movie? Like what you want them to keep in mind, or something you want them to take away from it?
I'd love to tell them that don't worry. It's all going to make sense in the end. Just enjoy the ride. And allow the experience to surprise you, and don't try and predict where it's going to go.
I love it. Thank you, Antonio, very, very much. The Devil All the Time on Netflix on September 16th. Thank you so much for your time today.
I really appreciate it. Thanks, Matt.
All right, take care.
When people look back on it, they had no other choice.
There's a lot of no good sons of bitches out there.
Excuse me, preacher. You got time for a sinner?
You know, I studied something. It's called the delusion. A belief that is untrue.
It is our delusion that lead us to sin. Delusions!
Some people were born just so they could be buried.
What I'm about to do, I do because I have to. Not because I want to.
Thank you so much for your time today, Lowell, and I'm really excited to talk about The Devil All the Time.
Oh, likewise. Thank you.
So first, I would just love to hear how you came to work on this project. What attracted you to the film?
I first met Antonio. I was just we have a mutual friend in director Brady Corbet, and I was just finishing shooting Vox Lux, and I'd met Antonio at various festivals in the past, and I sort of met him again at the end of that movie, and then a couple of months later, I was sent the script for it, you know. Yeah, you know, like it just immediately I was just taken with the cast of, you know, compelling and bizarre characters, you know, and a time scale that goes from the end of World War II through to the sort of late 1960s, you know.
Yeah.
And these kind of tormented characters, and, you know, and I guess the act of kind of like their relationships with religion and the idea of sort of salvation and the idea of, that idea of kind of like the idea that redemption is kind of accessible only through agony.
That's
quite appealing.
Yeah.
You know, and the sort of multi-stranded narrative. Yeah, I found it really compelling.
We're going to be talking to Antonio later this week. We're excited to hear from him as well. And this, like you said, this was your first time working with him. What was that working relationship like?
Oh, it's terrific. I mean, he's everything you hope for in the sense that he's incredibly collaborative. He's incredibly focused. He really is a great director to collaborate with. He gets great performances. A great sense of humor, you know, just, going into anything like this, it's a long time. It's a big commitment, shooting any movie. And you really want to just be in a position where a director really knows what it is they want. They know the film they're trying to make, but they also give, you know, they're not dictatorial. They're hopefully they've got the heads of department on board that sort of understand the film that he's trying to make and run with it, you know? So you have a huge amount of creative freedom, as long as it sort of exists within obviously the world that he's trying to create.
Yeah, that's great. And like you said, this film definitely spans a long period of time, huge ensemble, lots of very dark characters. With such a long time span and shooting so many storylines, how did that affect the way that you approached the visual style of the film?
Well, I think, I think one thing that we were very conscious of early on was that if we didn't want the film to feel sort of disparate, you know, and it needed a sort of cohesive whole.
Yeah.
At the same time, it also needed to be able to progress and develop and have these different time frames, you know. So, you know, we spoke about, you know, there's many differences or sort of contrasts in the film. One is that there's a chronological, the chronological aspect and the fact that it takes place over several decades. There's also the kind of rural environments and the not that we ever explore the big cities, but certainly more of the towns. So, you know, visually, we looked at the work of Andrew Wyeth quite a bit. Yeah. He was a big influence in, and in fact, there's one image where we see the church, the rural church, that very much is a kind of feels a bit like was informed by sort of Christina's World, the painting Christina's World. So I think the sort of browner tones and the palette within, and the compositions, of course, within Wyatt's work, we use that to sort of contrast with a stronger sense of modernity and the work of someone like William Eggleston and those early American photographers. Was important to us, you know. So immediately, you know, that what I mean is you've got, you know, we looked at photographers like Walker Evans, Builder Levy, Robert Frank, Dorothea Lang, you know, all these sort of documentarians that were capturing what it was like to exist in across America, you know, largely on the breadline, you know, in the 40s and 40s, 50s. And then contrasting that, like I say, with the kind of rise of color photography. Still documentarian in their approach, but, you know, people like William Eggleston, you know, so that, and that rise of the ektachrome. So then you have a contrast between the kind of more organic, natural colors, contrasting with more kind of like harsher vinyls and plastics and in the clothing, you know, more of a sort of more of an artificial color palette for some of those things. So yeah, that was kind of a lot of our basis.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And is it true that you shot the movie on 35mm?
Yeah, we did. That was something that when I came to the project, it was a discussion that had already been had.
Okay.
But Netflix were incredibly supportive and open to that, and it was never even in question. Just that's what Antonio wanted. If it ever came up, I think it was just, you know, reiterated how important it was to shoot this period film on 35. I personally, it's still my favorite format, shooting film over digital. And I think especially for this, it's so, you know, a film doesn't pick up on every single pore. It doesn't pick up on every single thread in the fabric, you know. It doesn't need to. It's not films that, you know, 35mm celluloid quality is not about seeing how many pixels you can, and trying to strive to be 6K, 8K upwards. Like that's not really what interests me about cinematography either, you know. And so I really think film was the medium for this one.
Hi, I'm Christina Yerling-Biro, host of the podcast Pop Culture Confidential. Join me as I go way behind the scenes with some of the most influential people in entertainment and media. Hear actors such as Succession's Brian Cox talk about his favorite characters to play.
There always has to be a mystery. The audience have to be in a situation where they want to know what's going on.
Meet studio execs like Pixar chief Pete Docter and learn his secret on how he makes us cry.
Emotion is our first language.
And so many others who are defining popular culture, from Obama speechwriter David Litt to Top Chef host Padma Lakshmi.
We don't often think about food politically, or we don't want to, but it really is.
Join me. Search for Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Like you already said, so much of this film takes place, you know, in backwoods of Ohio, and these really rural locations. How did the locations that you shot in and maybe the weather, because a lot of the film does take place outdoors, how did those things affect the shoot?
Well, I mean, photographically, it was, you know, it was tough. It was tough trying to shoot a scene that you know, takes place over. I see it takes place over maybe an hour or an hour and a half, and you're trying to shoot it like over 2 days, you know, right. Like at some point you have to commit to what the weather is telling you and what the look of the scene is. And then if you come back after lunch and it's completely overcast or vice versa, it's a real challenge, you know, and it's honest, there's not a great deal you can do about that. You know, you've got large areas that you're working with, you sort of up in the woods, shooting like 360 degrees, you need to be able to move quickly. You just have to do your best and lean into that. But it's certainly the biggest challenge of the film, I would say.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask, was was there any sequence that was particularly challenging for you to shoot?
Yeah, I think just with that in mind, there's the final scene with the final scene with Bodecker and Arvin, which is Tom Holland's character, and Sebastian Stan's character. They have this final shootout, and it was just, it's very tricky to try and make all that stuff match. And it was shot over like 2 days, so that was the biggest challenge for me, just trying to give some sort of visual continuity to the scene.
Yeah, definitely. From a cinematography perspective, how do you manage to take such dark material? A lot of this is very dark characters and disparate actions. How do you approach it to where the image isn't so dark? You know, a lot of times it seems like cinematography is trying to get darker and darker and darker. And your film wasn't. So
you've noticed?
I have noticed. So how did you manage to not go down that route, even with dark material?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's definitely some scenes in. I mean, my approach, just in terms of like what, you know, I've always been influenced by kind of Harris Cividés and Gordon Willis and those photographers that were never afraid to go dark in terms of, you know, photographically. I'm also somebody who's not afraid to. I'm sort of drawn to the darker side or certainly a more honest examination of human behavior. Anyway, you know, there's not a lot of, if any, sort of high key, highly lit comedies on my IMDb page. You know what I mean? Like that's what I'm drawn to. But so coming back to your question, you know, I think there are certain scenes that are dark photographically. One thing we were very conscious of was that early on, you know, Antonio didn't want the whole movie. It's sort of like a hat on a hat if you end up making very dark material, literally dark photographically. I think Antonio is very conscious of, like, in the beginning, it needs to feel hopeful, you know. Willard needs to have hope. His sense of sort of redemption needs to feel positive, you know, like he may be able to rescue Charlotte, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the scenes you know, even though it's sort of like dark ideas and dark approaches and dark solutions to these problems, early on it needs to feel hopeful, and then it gives us somewhere to go when hope is lost, really. And you know, and then that also is like seasonally early on in the movie, the prologue is kind of like there's much more green, it's kind of springtime. Yeah. Later on it's very much kind of like autumn time, And so the kind of that loss of hope is reflected also in the kind of the seasons that each scene is shot.
Yeah, no, that's great.
But I'm interested about your take on cinematography and that things are getting darker and darker.
Well, I mean, definitely it seems like, at least in blockbusters these days, it seems like the goal is to literally make the picture dark and shadowy. And sometimes it can work. You know, that's not to say it's always a bad thing. Not that everything should be brightly lit by any means. But sometimes it's a little on the nose.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if that's coming out of like studios just feeling, you know, there are films like Arrival or, Bradford's work is, you know, tends to kind of embrace the darkness. And then, you know, like, the new trailer for Batman looks pretty dark, you know. I suppose it's like there were movies like Seven. You know, when I was studying, you know, like, you know, 25 years ago or whatever, Seven was a movie that, you know, was like very dark photographically. But maybe it is a thing that, you know, like the biggest studios and like a Marvel movie or whatever is now in a position where it feels like its audience they're reassured, I suppose, they can go dark without losing audiences.
What are some of the things you're most proud of with this film, with Devil All the Time? What is there anything particularly that you really feel like is just an amazing shot or sequence that you really are proud of?
I think the night work works very well. I'm really happy with the interiors of Carl and Sandy's apartment, you know, and they're sort of like the decline of their sort of descent. I mean, their relationship has always been incredibly dark. I mean, they're serial killers, but it's sort of like, you know, yeah, I think there's definitely a kind of like there's a loss of enjoyment or loss of faith in what they're doing that I think sort of like manifests itself in their apartment. And I think just like, yeah, I'm always quite pleased when I shoot night scenes and night interiors, especially in rural environments that don't feel especially lit, you know?
Yeah.
And I've always tried to sort of like be quite bold and faithful to what I think that world would feel like. And so, yeah, if I've managed to tread that fine line between something that is like unusably underexposed and something that is kind of exciting in its darkness, then I'm always, especially with film where it's not like you see a monitor on set and you know what you're getting.
Right.
There's still always that danger that you've gone too far with it, and you know you get your dailies back, and there's a problem.
Right. Before I let you go, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. I saw that you shot Stephen Karam's The Humans, which should be coming out early next year. Many of my friends here at Next Best Picture are very excited for that adaptation. Is there anything you can tell me about that project?
Not really at the moment. No, I mean I'm just currently color timing it. So I get back to work on that next week, which is great. No, I mean equally, I'm just super excited to see how it's received.
Awesome. Yeah, we're very excited to see that. Well, Lowell, thank you so much for your work on this film, and thank you so much for your time. It was great speaking with you.
Likewise. You take care. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to my interview with the director and co-writer of The Devil All the Time, Antonio Campos, along with Daniel Howitt's interview with the cinematographer, Lowell Crawley, here on the Next Best Picture podcast. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Player FM, Acast, CastBox, and also on Spotify. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you will get some exclusive podcast content from us. The Devil All the Time is currently streaming on Netflix. We will see you all next time.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.